Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On this week's show...
I would say I'm a hopeless drunk, but that gives entirely the wrong impression. I'm literally hopeless in that I can't drink. I'll either, go to sleep or throw up.
Yes, I'll be finding out how teetotaler Tilda Swinton managed to become such a convincing alcoholic in her new film, Julia. In our extensive, exclusive podcast interview for Film Weekly, Tilda Swinton tells how being barred from a party in Cannes led to her biggest role for years. And I'll find out how Martin Scorsese is helping her to bring cinema to children everywhere. First up, though, British independent film, the kind we love here on Film Weekly, had its big night last Sunday. A glittering occasion it was too, attended by the likes of Keira Knightley, Sienna Miller, Steve McQueen, Ralph Fiennes and myself, no less glittering than Keira and Sienna, I'll have you know. The Biffers, as they are known, awarded Danny Boyle's Slumdog Millionaire the top prize of Best Film and Best Director, while Hunger carried off Best Actor for Michael Fassbender and Best Debut Director for Film Weekly regular Steve McQueen. The other big winner on the night was Mike Leigh's Happy-Go-Lucky, which carried off two supporting actor prizes, one for actress Alexis Zegerman and another for Eddie Marson as the world's scariest driving instructor, Scott.
Right, you see three mirrors, your two side-view mirrors and your rear-view mirror.
Yeah.
They make a golden triangle.
Oh, is that like the pubic triangle?
It's a pyramid, and at the top of the pyramid you see the all-seeing eye, En-Ra-Ha. Can you repeat that, please? En-Ra-Ha.
Are you talking about the eye of Lucifer?
No.
Because I don't know if I want to look in there, thank you very much.
It's not Lucifer. There are two fallen angels before Lucifer. There is En-Ra-Ha, Raziel, and Lucifer.
I'm sorry, I don't have them in my phone.
Well, bear with me.
Is there? Where is he?
Bear with me.
I can't see him.
It's a teaching tool.
Oh, is it?
Let me explain to you something about teaching, Poppy.
Go on, then.
The teacher's job is to bring out good habits in the pupil and to get rid of bad habits. He does that through frequent repetitive thinking. And he does that by creating clear and distinct images that are easy for the pupil to retain.
Oh. Does he now?
And I'm delighted to say that Eddie Marson joins me on the line for Film Weekly. Now, congratulations, Eddie, on your Biffa for Best Supporting Actor. What do you think it was about Scott, your driving instructor, that attracted the jury to awarding you?
Well, I think the way Mike Leigh works, he can create great characters because he's kind of... He was creating the character of Spot to be the antithesis of the character of Poppy. And I think that's why... people like Scott because it balances the film, really.
Yeah, I mean, was he based on? I know you came on the show way back in April when the film came out. Was he based on any particular driving instructor you might have had?
Not driving instructor. He was based on a few people that I knew. But when you say based, by the time you create the character to film it. There's bears little resemblance to the original source material.
Yeah, I don't know anyone like Scott, thankfully. but it is a terrific performance from you. And what's most terrific about it is that most of it, when I noticed sort of seeing the film again, is done sitting down.
Yes, yeah. But I think there's only two scenes where I get out of the car.
Amazing. Is that difficult in acting? I know you've acted in all sorts of places for all sorts of directors, but I mean, what's that acting in a small car for Mike Leigh like?
I tell you, it's easier because we had the lipstick cameras, so that means we weren't on what you call a low loader. It means that we could allow the car to express what was going on in the arguments. If you was on a low loader, it would have been very hard for me to kind of express all that pent up anger because somebody else would have been in reality driving the car. But because I was driving the car, I could express it.
So you do your own stunts, Eddie? Is that what you're telling me?
I do, yeah, I do, for the right money.
I mean, it's been, I thought Sunday night was a terrific night down at the Biffers, wasn't it? I mean, the actual sort of people that attended such an event was amazing.
Yeah, I know, and every year it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, I like it because it's a bit of a jolly, really, because you go to things like the BAFTAs and other awards, and there's so many people you don't know. You go to the Biffers and you know everybody because you work with them all.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that's probably why you get the people who are nominated and they don't know they've even won. They turn up because it is kind of like an industry outing, isn't it?
It is. It is. Exactly. Yeah, the people at the Biffers are like on the front line of British filmmaking.
Yeah, and I've got to say that the ones that won, the nominees, and the sort of were all the best films, really. They really were a terrific lineup. Sense that, Eddie? Because I know you've been in Hancock with Will Smith this year. You've worked with Terrence Malick and Martin Scorsese, but you're also kind of doing, you've done the Vera Drakes, you've done the Happy-Go-Luckys, the Faint Hearts, that's one of your lovely little performances of yours coming up in the new year. Working back at home, do you really feel that there's a sort of energy in British film at the moment?
Yes, there is. I think there is. I think we've got some fantastic fantastic directors. You've got Danny Boyle. I think these guys are just, they're basically fighting to get money. And because they're fighting to get money, they're already kind of tanked up to make a good film anyway. When they get their money, they can't let the opportunity go. So they give it 110%. None of them are lackadaisical in the British film because you can't afford to be, really.
Yeah. I mean, what's it like just thinking of you in Hancock? I'd almost forgotten about that, your villainous role in Hancock. But you've gone from playing the villainous Scott in a small car driving around the streets of North London to a massive film with one of the world's biggest movie stars. Do you register that, or do you just get on with the job of acting?
Well, there's nothing like being compared to doing a year with Mike Lee. Will Smith is a pussycat compared to doing a year with Mike Lee, to be honest with you. I mean, I literally went from my last day shooting on the Holloway Road in Happy Go Lucky to 2 days later trying to kill Will Smith in Hancock.
You could have just taken the car as Scott and tried to run him down.
I could have. There actually was a review that said it looks like Eddie Marsden's just stepped off the set of Happy Go Lucky, and I had.
Some of those critics, they know what they're talking about.
They do.
I've got to congratulate you too. I did on Sunday night when I saw you down at the Biffers on your performance currently ongoing as Panks in Little Dorrit. What a wonderful character.
Yeah, I know. You see, I think that's what I was saying earlier. I think it's the characters that make the performance. You know, if you're given a great character, you just got to do it. You've got to serve the character and do it well, you know. And so you're 90% there if you've got a great character.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, Dickens characters, Boz has done a few sketches, so you can kind of inhabit. Where did you get Panks from? Because you give him that little snort and you give him the bald cut. Where did you base him on? He's fascinating me at the moment. I love him.
I tell you what, Dickens describes the snorts. All the snorts come from Dickens. But we decided to make Panks look like a bull terrier. I thought when my kids love to watch Oliver, the Lionel Bart musical.
Yeah.
And Bill Sykes has this dog called Bullseye. And I kind of thought, actually, if you based a character on Bullseye, I made him a rent collector. And that's what Panks is. He's like Bullseye.
Yeah, and he's a lethal. He's exactly what he's like. He's a lethal combination, isn't he?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you treat him well, he'll be like a puppy for you. But if you go against him, he'll rip your throat out.
Yeah. Well, Eddie, I don't know what the awards for telly. They BAFTAs and all. Because I just think he's a terrific, terrific character.
Thank you very much.
And I'm loving what you do. Give us a little snort, will you? Before you go.
There you go.
Oh, you've got me ready. I'm looking forward to seeing you in Faintheart as well. I've actually seen that film and a sort of different British film as well. Kind of a rom. But you're manful in it, mate. You actually kind of carry that film over the finishing line. It is a terrific, lovely performance again.
Thank you very much, Jason. Tell
the Film Weekly listeners about that in a nutshell before.
Well, basically, it's a film that was it's been directed by Vito Rocco, and it won a competition on MySpace. But it was already a well written film before it got to the MySpace competition, and it's about a guy who's a weekend Viking. And it's about a bunch of blokes, really, who can't find their masculinity in the 21st century, so they become Vikings at weekends. And the film really is about them having to balance the two. They have to find the hero in themselves in the 21st century.
Yeah, well, I think you found the anti-hero in Scott, and you certainly find the hero in Faintheart, Eddie. It's great pleasure. It gives me great pleasure to see you doing so well and getting recognised for it now after so many years of sort of great character work where people didn't recognise you because they always put you in wigs and beards and stuff. But now we get to know what you look like a bit.
Thank you very much, Jason. That's very kind.
Thanks for joining us. And
all the best.
Congratulations.
Bye-bye.
On that, Biffa. Ta-da. You're listening to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons, but it's time to get down to the nitty-gritty of the show, to the business of our review section for this week. Joining me, of course, is Guardian film critic at large and Film Weekly regular, Zan Brooks. Welcome to the pod, Zan.
Thank you, Jason. Lovely to be here.
A very busy week indeed. 13 official releases this week.
Yeah, unlucky. Unlucky for some, I think. Unlucky for you.
Yeah, unlucky for me. I'm standing in for Philip French on The Observer this week, so I have to see them all. Although even The Observer, who would like to be a paper of record, have said we just don't have room for 13 films, or if we did, it would just be a sort of who's in them and how long they are. But I mean, why do they have these weeks? Because next week there are 12 films out. Why do they have these weeks where distributors seem to be sort of uncluttering their store cupboard?
Well, I mean, I guess it's a cynical move by the distributor to sort of provide a little shop window display to say, when the film eventually goes onto DVD, to say, you know, it was in cinemas, therefore is a thing of quality.
Yeah.
As if that's ever been proof of quality.
And Zan and Jason gave them two mics up.
Exactly. Yeah. We sat there, and even if nobody else did.
Yes. Well, in a way, we see them so we don't have to. But what we can do on Film Weekly is whittle the choices down and select the best, or at least the most interesting to discuss, and make people make their own minds up. That is the job, after all, of film critics. So let's get on with that job, Zan. We'll review this week, out of the morass of films that there is, we shall review Lakeview Terrace, we shall review Trouble the water. And we shall give a little nod to Julia. So let's start with Lakeview Terrace, which stars Samuel L. Jackson and is directed by Neil LaBute. Neil LaBute back in action after films such as Nurse Betty and In the Company of Men. Samuel L. Jackson plays Abel Turner, a police officer with the LAPD, living next door at new arrivals in Lakeview Terrace, an interracial couple played by Patrick Wilson and Kerry Washington. Samuel does not approve.
I'm sorry, is there something you want to say?
No.
You seem to have an opinion about law enforcement. I'd like to hear it.
Let's talk about something else.
Oh, no. We could talk about something else, but I think your friends want to talk about this.
I just find that there's an attitude.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a kind of aggressiveness when you deal with them, which I can certainly understand.
I'm sorry, Miss,
Eden.
Eden. Well, Eden, when you're getting jacked outside your loft and W here doesn't have the energy to stop it, we'll see about sending the nice police over to help you. That's if it's not too late.
So, Zan, Samuel L. Jackson as your nosy neighbour is probably not what you want to see first thing in the morning.
No, it's not. This is a kind of neat twist, isn't it? This is almost like one of those scriptwriting workshops where they take a kind of an old cliche and then try and flip it. So, you know, let's make the racist cop a black man. And therein lies the twist in the film. And it's perfectly suited to Neil LaBute, who is a kind of professional controversialist in a way, and is always kind of, you know, digging at taboos and trying to get people kind of riled up.
Interesting career he's had, Neil LaBute. I mean, he made a lot of films, strangely
enough. A lot of bad films as well. You know, he did In the Company of Men right at the start, which is fantastic. But his last film was the remake of The Wicker Man, which was seen as like one of the great turkeys of last year. And this is far, far better than that. It's a little bit crude at times. I think he's maybe a better writer than he is a director. But it has got a fantastic performance by Samuel L. Jackson, who, as you were saying, has kind of been spinning his wheels a bit lately.
He's got very
kind of lazy. You know, he was one of the great actors of the 1990s who kind of lost his way. And here he's back. And so, no, it's great. It's a sort of portrayal of rage, really, that he does great.
It is amazing that it is a film that says stuff that other films perhaps wouldn't say. And you get that in Neil LaBute, who did it, I suppose, in The Company of Men and The Shape of Things. He talks about sex quite often and sexual politics quite often. And you think in a way that makes you feel most uncomfortable, like you don't really want to watch. And he does it here with race, which I suppose now in post-Barack or current Barack America is even a sort of a strange potato. It's not hot. It's kind of lukewarm. Warm. We don't know which way it's going to go.
Yeah, and this film kind of almost admits that you don't know which way it's going to go. It's a very clever film on race. Even though it pushes wildly at times at a lot of buttons, it doesn't kind of draw any easy conclusions. You know, it's not a film of like, why can't we all get along? It just shows, you know, it exposes, you know, black prejudice as opposed to white prejudice, but it also kind of highlights a sort of certain strain of liberal guilt and a certain cynical appropriation of black culture by the kind of white elite.
Yeah, how does it do that?
Well, the character of Chris by Patrick Wilson, who's the sort of the yuppie who moves in with his you know, black wife, you know, he has friends with trophy Asian girlfriends. He likes sitting in his car listening to kind of rap music. And it's all a little bit of a pose, I think.
There's that lovely moment
where
you can kind of feel
Samuel L. Jackson's annoyance at it.
Yeah, and you love that lovely moment when he shuffles along, kind of sleepy, and you think, oh, well, he looks like a nice bloke. He's got a family. Then he kind of knocks on the window of this guy and his new arrival. He's listening to rap music. He goes, it's all very good with your rap music, but you can listen to it all night long, but you wake up in the morning, you'll still be white.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
None of it. The audience don't know what to say. Patrick Wilson doesn't know what to say. You're like, what can I say? And it's that. And then even the black wife has a sort of issue of her own. Kerry Washington, who I think is a superb actress, was great in The Last King of Scotland. She's there thinking, you know, have I done wrong? Have I selling out by marrying this white guy? But I love him. And then the white guy's thinking, well, have I gone wrong? And her
Absolutely.
Dad doesn't like the white guy.
Well, this is the thing, that Samuel L. Jackson isn't seen as this kind of lone crazy. There's you know, the implication that he's representative of quite a broad section of society, with the Kerry Washington's father having a kind of similar disapproval, though maybe not quite as murderous, but it's there.
and there is, as you say, that wonderful dinner party conversation where they invite Abel Turner, play by Samuel, over to the dinner party, and everyone's there, and they're like kind of young yuppies. And as you say, there's Asian girlfriends, there's someone's an Indian girlfriend, they've all been to Tibet, and they've got pot, and he just does not kind of what this kind of, you know, Ivy League kind of, you know, middle classness. He just has got no truck with, because he's spent 28 years.
And you kind of agree with him.
Yeah.
You agree with him.
And he's on the streets. That's where we get a little scene when he goes on the streets and everyone's calling him Wigger this, Wigger that, Japa Mexican, Japastani, Cherokee, yeah. And all that mix. And it reminded me of a very underrated film, I thought, that David Ayer directed with Keanu Reeves not so long ago on the streets of Los Angeles, and that one about corrupt LA cops with Kurt Russell, Dark Blue, that all seemed to finish with this combustible image of fires in LA and helicopters swooming
around. And it reminded me a little bit as well of a James Toback film called Black and White,
yeah.
Which was a bit of a mess of a film, but tackled a lot of this similar, very charged, tricky area.
In which Mike Tyson smacked Robert Downey Jr. around the head
for coming onto it.
Yeah, and then Robert Downey Jr. ends up playing a black guy in Tropic Thunder.
Yes, it's a thriller that does the job as a thriller, but it is something that kind of, you know, nags at your mind and you want to discuss afterwards.
Yeah, unusually for what I think is a decent Friday Night Out movie as well, has got a lot to talk of there. And also it's got a bit of Destiny's Child music going on as well.
That's always a winner for you.
Yeah, exactly, Zan. That's Lakeview Terrace, and we recommend it this weekend, don't we? Yes, we do. Let's deal with race again, and let's trouble the waters of race with a new documentary called Trouble the Water, set après le déluge, or in fact during the deluge in New Orleans in 2005. It's a film, a documentary, taken mostly from the camera of a woman caught in that deluge.
Oh, be with us, Lord, please.
Oh, let's water. Come and do the wonders.
Hey, help us get off the roof, man. You're a real hero, boy.
We under siege, truly under siege. Everybody done lost everything around here.
Now, you have seen what Katrina has done to us. She stuck us in her attic. I'm running out of juice, too.
Zan, Trouble the Water, it's on the Oscar shortlist to be nominated. Could get nominated for Best Documentary. It's also being nominated for Independent Spirit Awards, and it won the Gotham Awards, one of New York's kind of indie film awards, only this week in New York. Is it meriting all these awards?
I think it is. I mean, it's very crude, it's lo-fi, but that's its nature. It's a sort of camcorder diary by a young New Orleans rapper called Kimberly Roberts, who was there at the time of Hurricane Katrina.
Black Cold Medina, to give her a rap name.
Sorry, yeah, of course. I'm already falling into liberal white kind of, let's get away from all that. And her footage is kind of augmented with news footage. But it's has a sort of an on-the-ground kind of eyewitness account that this really works brilliantly. It's totally gripping. It's harrowing. It exposes the whole kind of tragedy and the corruption of Hurricane Katrina, the total lack of evacuation provision that forced people to kind of hole up in their attics, where there's kind of old women and babies up there as the flood waters are rising. It's terrifying.
It's slightly amazing as well, because you're watching the waters rise. Literally, we knew how it did because we saw it on news footage. But actually, when most news cameramen had to go, in fact, there's a little sort of cameo by one news cameraman trying to brave the storm, and he gets blown over.
Yeah.
Quite amusingly. But she's staying in her house when the rest of the neighbourhood is moving out. She goes, and you're just watching the waters rise. It's kind of like that moment in Star Wars where the walls are closing in, and you're just watching someone slowly drowning, and you're thinking, is that water going to come up over the camera?
And then, of course, the kind of horrible aftermath of it, where, you know, these people are basically left to their own devices, and the US authorities are sort of, you know, largely either ill-equipped or uninterested in helping them. And it kind of exposes, you know, what might be said is the US establishment's view of a predominantly black underclass, that they're not citizens, they're scavengers. They're kind of desperate opportunists and wild beasts to be kind of, you know, kept away from.
Well, there's that naval base
society.
They go to for rescue from naval base, and they get turned away
at gunpoint.
At gunpoint. And then the naval base gets commended for its bravery in the face of assault, like zombies had been at the gates, and they were the kind of the last homesteaders, you know, sending them off. I mean, it's an extraordinary real-life portrayal of what we see in the movies as well, a sort of a kind of apocalyptic breakdown.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and it also has to be said that the ultimate documentary on Hurricane Katrina remains Spike Lee's When the Levees Broke, which was a big four-hour overview that tackled kind of every single thing. But this is an interesting counterpoint to it, because it is a personal kind of journey through it from somebody who was there. And it's absorbing.
And it's then been edited. I mean, some real film editors got hold of this raw footage and kind of pieced a film together around it. It doesn't have, as you say, the epic grandeur or kind of investigative rigour of Spike Lee's When the Levees Broke, but it doesn't have the budget of it either. And it has this extraordinary woman at the heart of it who's not so angry, actually. I mean, we're saying it's extraordinary. And I didn't find the film actually that angry. I found them actually rather charming company, a charismatic company, and they were almost...
They're kind of stoical.
Yeah.
They're kind of just getting on with it and surviving. And I guess it's for the viewer to watch and think, surely this could have been handled better than it was.
Zan, that's Trouble the Water. And I sincerely think that this might be an Oscar-winning documentary right here, just because of the political situation. I love Man on Wire very much, and I'm sure that will get nominated.
It's been a good year for documentaries. And you know, if you count Waltz with Bashir as a documentary too, you've got three real strong contenders there.
Yeah, absolutely. Trouble the Water, an extraordinary thing. And actually some good music in that film as well. I know I mentioned Destiny's Child in Lakeview Terrace, but this has got Dr. John Lee Hookie, Mary, The Roots, and of course Black Coal Medina doing her rapping as well. And the title track, Trouble the Water, which has come out of this, is, I thought, a thumping good tune.
Yeah.
Let's turn it to Julia, just before we go and hear from Tilda Swinton, the star of Julia herself. This film, directed by Eric Zonka, which stars 144 minutes worth of Tilda Swinton. Is that enough? Too much?
I think it actually is enough. And a lot of people are quite down on this film, and you know, it is a bit of a mess. It's Tilda Swinton playing a kind of brassy, ballsy drunk in Los Angeles who abducts a kid in a kind of scam that obviously goes horribly wrong. And she ends up in Tijuana in Mexico, sort of, you know, embroiled with gangsters. It gets a little hysterical. It's directed by a very talented French director called Eric Zonka, who did Dream Life of Angels 10 years ago, which was great. Apparently, Zonka has had a sort of alcohol problem himself in the past. And almost it's like a film about a drunk that's by a drunk, in that it's a little bit wayward, a little bit out of control. It's like a sort of a great shot of bourbon that you don't know where it's going to go next.
Plus, there are moments of great excitement and moments of great boredom where you think, oh, I really should leave you alone in the corner for a bit.
Exactly. But the excitement just about outweighs
it. I thought it was a fascinating, if flawed, film, and that's why I got Tilda Swinton on to talk about it. I'm very glad that you liked it. I wasn't expecting you to
And she's brilliant
like
in it.
She's brilliant in it. Zan, you've been brilliant this week, as ever. Let's move swiftly from Zan to Tilda Swinton. It's not a long jump, but you'll stay with us here on Film Weekly. Zan, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Now to our exclusive podcast interview of the week. Tilda Swinton has achieved something most of her peers crave: critical and commercial success. From the art house to the multiplex, she's a British actress rarely off the big screen, from her role as the White Witch in the Narnia films to her Oscar-winning performance in Michael Clayton opposite George Clooney, with whom she appears again in the Coen brothers' latest film, Burn After Reading. Tilda's become part of Hollywood royalty, yet lives in the Scottish Highlands. However, most of her roles have been supporting ones, not in Julia. Her latest film finds Swinton literally and metaphorically swaggering, howling and stomping across the screen from the very first frame. Before we hear from Tilda Swinton herself, let's get a taster of her in action. Let's take a tequila shot of Eric Zonka's Julia.
OK, well, then she has to pay for it. And it's time my luck changed, and it's time something went right for me for change, and you.
Yeah, how's that going to happen?
It's simple. OK, listen here. I go with her, I get the kid. Sweet, okay. And then, here's the kicker. We kidnap the kid from her.
Oh, Jesus Christ,
We kidnap the kid from her. Listen to me, we're coming back in the car. I think of something, you know me, I'll think of something. Yeah, and I stop the car, and you're there, right? You're there, and you separate them, and you take the kid, and you take off.
I'm eating satsumas, easy pill satsumas with Tilda Swinton, which is a vaguely erotic experience, I have to
say. Well, I'm glad that you didn't switch on the thing when I was peeling them, because it would have sounded like I had scrofula or something. I was scratching away at the surface.
Well, I'm glad you don't have scrofula, although
I could have, and no one would know.
Well, no one would probably see it, but given that your character Julia in your latest film, she probably does have scrofula.
Probably does have pretty much everything, I would say. All sorts of things we are not going to ask about.
Well, that in that case, I'm going to ask what attracted you to playing her, because she's quite an unattractive person.
You see, this is where I begin to feel I might be out of whack, because I don't find her unattractive. I mean, she does unattractive things, and she holds some unattractive attitudes, but I don't find her unattractive. I find her very attractive, in the sense that she seems... There's something about her energy and her verve, which I do find literally attractive, magnetic in a way.
Well, half the menfolk of whatever area it is, so New Mexico seemed to find her attractive as well.
Well, I think she... I've known a lot of people like her, to be honest with you, Jason.
Oh.
Yeah, she's very familiar to me.
No, me too, actually, I have to say. So I don't... When I say unattractive, it's kind of... Because she's glamorous as well. My God, you get to wear some quite good clothes in this
film. Well, she was... Let's be a little unkind now. She was hot 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But it's all going south. And she's not, she's in denial about it. You know, she only really looks in the mirror probably when she's drunk enough to think she's still 19. Mm. And it's all, she's carrying literally the weight of those 20 years. And it's heavy. Mm.
Do you, are you an actress that does things like that? Because we know you talk about that. That's a really strong backstory to your character that doesn't make it onto the screen. Are you an actress that does that? Because I've always thought that you were a more instinctive performer rather than one that kind of thinks one's way through the role. And I mean that in the most kind of flattering way.
Well, what one has to think oneself through is becoming, looking as, not so much convincing as the character, but as least distracting as possible. I mean, if I'm going to play someone who's been a good time girl for 20 years and has been like a major proper going alcoholic, then I can't really have my own frame. It was important to flesh her out literally and to eat a lot of pies and to put things on my face and have a kind of hair that felt right. You know, that sort of disguise does need to be thought through because that's all about just trying to make oneself as convincing as possible, or as I say, as least distracting. If I turned up looking like myself playing Julia, then people would go, but hang on, why has she got that kind of great haircut? And why does she not look like she's drunk for 20 years? So that part of it is quite thought through. Yeah. But then once we start shooting, I like to not do any work at all and just play.
But what about, in this sense, this is probably a good case in point, you're not an actress, for example, who would say, well, I need to go to AA meetings and find out how that works, or I need to kind of talk to alcoholics to find out how that kind of method-y type.
No, well, the truth is, I was, I very much knew the territory of this world. I have, like most of us have, whether we kind of know or admit it or not, hung out with a lot of alcoholics in my life, and in one way or another. And I do know the territory from second hand. So no, I did feel that I had some grasp of it.
Do you not drink yourself?
No, I can't. I would say I'm a hopeless drunk, but that gives entirely the wrong impression. I'm literally hopeless in that I can't drink. I'll either, go to sleep or throw up. What I have done is I've pretended to be drunk for the last 20 years with friends of mine who are properly drunk, and I'm always the one who, when the police are called, can turn the music down and drive everybody home.
Oh, you're good. I must have you. Designated driver, Tilda Swinton.
Yeah.
It is a great role, and I presume that's what attracted you to it, because it is the first time I really think for a very, very long time that we've seen you in a film from start to finish, probably since Orlando, I have to say.
No, well, I made a film called The Deep End in which I was in pretty much every frame. And I also made a film with Lynn Hirschman called Technolust, which hasn't been so widely seen because it's kind of...
That never came out here, did it?
I don't know that it did. It's a very much a fine art circuit film. Mm. The honest truth is that I've had small children for the last 10 years, and so the kind of commitment just in terms of time and attention that being in every frame of a film takes doesn't go well with a rule that I have, which is that I can't be away from my children for more than 3 weeks. So I've been, for the last few years, I've been going in and out of other people's films, doing a bit of surgical striking. But I'm now,
I've always enjoyed it. Like Thumbsucker, for example.
Me too. And it's been more than enjoyable. It's been extremely educational, and I feel, and it's also been what can only be described as profitable, in the sense that, I am now seen as having worked in a more viable side of the business. So it's possible now to raise money more easily for the projects that I'm developing myself. But I am kind of returning, and Julia is the first project that marks this return to being more involved in my own work.
And are you? I know you've done sort of independent movies. You mentioned Scott McGee, the lovely Deep End, which was the bluest film I've ever seen. It was
bluer than blue. No.
But blue, like your blue eyes, blue. Yeah, it was really blue. And then you had the indie stuff that you did here. Mm-hmm. Are we seeing a return to more indie stuff,
well,
if there's
more,
any?
Well, indie in the sense that it's indie in that it's not studio, and indie also in that it's generated with my filmmaking colleagues rather than you know, any people I don't know coming to me with projects that they've already got up and mm. and running, like the Coen brothers or Tony Gilroy, who, you know, they don't need my help to raise the money for their films. I'm working in Europe again as well mm. with European filmmakers, and Eric Zonka is the first. He's a Frenchman.
Yes, he hasn't worked for a long time either. Well, he hasn't made a film for a long time.
No, he hasn't. He's been working on this.
Oh, right. And was it you that he wanted in this? Because Dream Life of Angels was a beautiful film. And it actually chimes slightly with this at the beginning, that there are dreams floating around in this. Beautiful film, Elodie Boucher and Natasha Aigné, I think. Was this always going to be an English language project? Did he have you in mind?
I met him years ago, about 7 years ago, in Cannes, in the really, really bizarre and kind of hilarious circumstances, when we were both at the film festival and the closing night party wouldn't let either of us in. We were both in some official capacity. I was presenting a prize and he was on a short film jury, and we both had an absolute right to be there, and for some reason they wouldn't let us in, and we just became quite helpless with laughter, and I remember trying to storm a door with a fire extinguisher, and that was it. That was the extent of our contact. And then we had a mutual friend who told me in the intervening years that he was developing a film for me, and I thought this was very strange because he'd only just, you know, met me this once. And then and then your question about whether it was always going to be English language leads to an interesting piece of information, which is that apparently when he was developing it originally, he'd never made a film outside of France. He was developing it as a European story, I'm assuming it was going to be European woman, and needed a border between two geographical states that were really quite dissimilar from one another to mirror this change of state in Julia, and couldn't find a border in Europe that he felt would suffice, and at that point decided that it should be an American film. But even when I was on board, we talked about the possibility of her being Scottish, for example, and then talked ourselves out of it because we
crashing through Hadrian's Wall.
No, not in Scotland. As some ex Caledonian Airways air hostess, having, you know, washed up in Los Angeles. But she. We felt she needed to be American. She needed to be identified with the place that she was crashing away from.
Yeah. How, when you said that you hadn't performed for a while because you were raising your children as well, which must have been, I assume, a pleasure and a bit of bliss for you. Did you miss making films? Did you miss performing? I'm never sure if you're someone who actually loves performing. I can't think of you doing anything else.
Well, I do other things, to be honest with you. I mean, when I'm... The bulk of my work is not actually dressing up and playing, as I would describe it properly. It's developing projects with people and dreaming things up and chewing my own personal cud. That takes up most of my year. And actually shooting, if you're lucky, shooting will only occupy maybe 4 months of any 12-month mm-hmm. year. And the rest of the time is, as I say, just working it all out.
And that includes your film festival, of course.
That includes the film festival that I started this year with Mark Cousins in Nairn, where I live, the Cinema of Dreams. And we're already commissioned by the Scottish Government to create a Cinema of Dreams in Beijing in March, which we're going to do.
On the same sort of lines, the sort of children's selection.
It's not exactly a children's selection. I mean, there's a confusion which arises quite naturally from the fact that Mark Cousins and I are also partners in inaugurating a foundation called the 8.5 Foundation, which is a foundation that we're setting up to give rise to a birthday, an 8.5 birthday for children, which is their cinema day, which we deem to be the perfect age to fall in love with cinema. And we're going to set up a website where children can, you know, peruse a menu that we've curated of world cinema that we think is a great way to start falling in love with cinema. And then they can write to us and we will send them a box for their birthday with a film in it. I have to tell you, it's very exciting that we are we've been approached by the World Cinema Foundation, which is run by Alberto Luna and Martin Scorsese, who are an organisation who take endangered world cinema and and restore and make prints and disseminate great classic cinema.
We had Tuki Buki here at the London Film Festival, which they'd rescued.
There you have it. Well, they want to be partners with 8.5, and they want to help us. And what they're doing first off is that they're going to take a film which Mark and I have chosen as our kind of first signature film, which is this great Iranian film by Mohammad El-Talebi called The Boot, which is an extraordinary film for any age, about a young girl who's given a pair of red rubber boots and loses one of them, and about her search through the city of Tehran for her second boot and the way in which her neighbours help her to find it. It's a really extraordinary piece of work, and they are going to help us to... They're going to restore this film. Wow. Well, it's not so much restoring, because it's not that it's a damaged print or anything, but they're going to make accessible a print and DVDs of this film and help us with distribution, and that's a really big deal for us.
Well, it's lovely to have you back.
Thank you.
Doing so many films and in on screen so much in Julia.
Thank you very much.
Also, a terrific performance, nice haircut.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations on the film to boot.
Thank you very much indeed.
A huge Film Weekly thanks to Tilda Swinton for her time there. And Julia is on nationwide release from Friday, the 5th of December. And as Zan and I discussed in our review section, it's an intriguing must-see. Well, that's all we've got for this week. Next week, I'll be talking to Sophie Okonedo about her role in The Secret Life of Bees. And Israeli director Eran Riklis joins me to talk about his poignant new film, Lemon Tree. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday. I'm standing in for the great Philip French, so I'll be reviewing every film out this week. And why not join me on Facebook? Film Weekly Fans is the group. There are just 18 members so far, so it's still an intimate dinner party affair, but we'd love to hear from you on what you think of the films and of any items, of course, that appear on Film Weekly. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.